Never make a film with kids or animals, and never set your film on a boat. These are words for filmmakers to live by due to the high level of difficulty each one offers. Kids and dogs must be trained, and they're easily tired or distracted, and their performances rarely seem authentic. Boats, on the other hand, are their own unique complication. Their movement is affected by forces that no filmmaker can control, and therefore you're fighting to keep your angles and lighting correct as your set moves under your feet. You have safety problems. You have a very limited set of tools for stabilizing and lighting shots and moving your camera, and your cast and crew can get seasick. Maybe consider writing a nice story about a soldier in an army and save yourself some trouble? No. Naval combat is something of an obsession for us on this show, in part because of the challenges inherent to doing it right, and in part because of the fascinating limitations the sea imposes on combat itself. As new technologies like CGI boats and drone cameras emerge to reduce some of the barriers to filming on the water, I'm hoping we get more and more of these films. But even with these advancements, it's still much easier to set a naval warfare film on a modern naval vessel. Rare is the film that allows us to explore the finer points of naval combat prior to World War II. Once in a blue moon, a master and commander comes along and gives us a glimpse into a more blessed timeline, where movies like this are made all the time. But in our doomed reality, Master and Commander, despite being a perfect film, was not financially successful enough to spawn its deserved cavalcades of sequels and imitators. South Korea, thankfully, is not bound by the same creative constraints as Hollywood, and one of the most successful films to ever be released there is a film about a naval battle between Japan and Korea that took place the same year that Shakespeare's Henry IV Parts 1 and 2 was first performed, the same year that the Third Spanish Armada tried and failed to invade England. It's a 2014 film directed by Han Min Kim that covers the Battle of Myeongnyang and the long-shot victory achieved by Yi Sun Sin against the invading Japanese. The style of ships is very different from the ones we see in Master and Commander. Their squared-off hulls engender a totally different set of strategies and tactics in ship-to-ship combat. The ships are oar-powered, and the film is just as interested in the men struggling to propel the ships as it is the ones on deck firing arrows and swinging swords. The action takes place in the Myeongnyang Strait, a slip of water notorious for the film's eponymous roaring currents. The badly outnumbered Joseon Navy that Yi commands makes clever use of their home water advantage and, like the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae, thwart a Japanese invasion fleet of 333 ships with a mere 12. We love a classic David and Goliath story on friendly fire. You map that onto a naval battle and we're all yours. There's something deeply gratifying about seeing a small, outgunned force overcome the odds. It's a feeling we want to revisit more and more these days, and to follow the example of those figures of history who didn't lose hope even when everything and everyone around them said they were already defeated. This is a universal human story. If you crave life, you will surely die. If you fight to the death, you will live. Today on Friendly Fire, The Admiral, Roaring Currents. Welcome to Friendly Fire, the war movie podcast that burned our own houses down before we started recording today. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
That's the only way I'm going to be sure that you guys take to the seas. I'm John Roderick.
I love that move.
Are you the admiral of this podcast?
Is that what you keep doing by not recording introductions to the show? Is that your version of burning down our houses?
I'm the admiral of this show in the sense that I never smile or answer any direct question put to me.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about this movie. Very, very, very popular movie in South Korea. I kind of got the sense reading the Wikipedia article that this admiral, Yi Sun Sin, and this battle were like very famous kind of formative stories in the Korean
in the, you know, in Korean history. I imagine this is like something you learn in elementary school if you're a South Korean student.
Yeah, it definitely has the feeling of a foundation myth, and or not myth, but like a foundation story. And it also feels like some of that is necessary to fully understand the film. Like, I imagine a South Korean or a Korean audience would be as familiar with the events depicted here as we are of the events of the Revolutionary War or whatever. You don't have to explain
right
who everybody is or what the stakes are. But that's not entirely clear to an audience coming at this movie from a Western perspective.
Like the Battle of Red Cliffs movie that we watched, like everybody gets their title card and their rank and, you know, their statistics, their turn-ons. Everybody gets their Playboy centerfold.
They all get Murdoch'd.
Yeah. And this movie definitely gives a little kind of perfunctory setup, because the Koreans had a navy that was like about the same size as the Japanese navy, and the admiral that took control of that fleet when Yi Sun-sin was wrongly accused of treason or something, like, was totally incompetent, and like he got his ass kicked in this naval battle and then just like took the rest of his fleet back somewhere and like sat in his ship for a week and wouldn't talk to anyone, like totally just brooding and ashamed of himself, and somehow like just let the rest of the fleet get taken apart, like while he was in that state. Like all but 12 ships in the Korean Navy get destroyed by the Japanese.
Can you imagine the Korean government after seeing this go down? Like, the scene we don't get in this movie is them going back to Yi and being like, mistakes were made.
I know, like, I kind of think that, this movie was so successful. Maybe there's
a prequel.
Maybe there's a prequel in the works, but like, I feel like that's the story I want to see.
Yeah.
Right. That would have been, well, yeah, a major battle. I think one of the interesting things about this movie, and we see this all the time from our perspective, watching movies about World War II or Western movies, that we think nothing of watching British actors play Nazi officers, for instance. In this movie, almost all of the Japanese characters are played by Korean actors.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah, the head general on the Japanese side is played by a guy who used to be like the Minister of Culture for Korea.
And that's that's really... it's very clear from the uniforms and the costumes, you know, who the sides are and what all is happening. There is a character that is a defector or a spy who's working for the Koreans but is Japanese. In some of the earlier scenes, when they're not in their war costumes, but they're kind of in more courtly dress, or people are moving back and forth between environments, coming and going from scenes of the peasants being persecuted, scenes of different sort of court spaces. There was a little bit of a narrative juggling for me, like, now what? Now wait a minute. Now who's talking to who right here? And that would have been, this is another one where if the subtitles were different colors for when they're speaking Korean or when they're speaking Japanese.
Right. Yeah.
That would have been very helpful just in orienting yourself in space. I watched this movie with someone who speaks a little bit Japanese, and she said the Koreans are doing a terrible job of speaking Japanese in this movie.
Oh, did that take you out of the movie?
Really did for me. I was like, sayonara.
I mean, that may be true about the accents, but God, the costumes were incredible in this movie.
Right.
Yeah.
The details in it, I think, far outweighed whatever linguistic challenges might have been faced by some viewers. Like, holy shit.
I liked seeing all those Ron haircuts on the Japanese
much,
generals.
So much.
I thought a lot about that movie when I was watching this one. You're just not going to get a Kurosawa film anymore. Like, you're going to tell Kurosawa stories, but they're always going to look like this from now on. And I got to admit, I approached the film with a little bit of reluctance. I was thinking, chances are this could be a Red Bad situation.
Yeah.
But it was not. It was more Ron than it was Red Bad, for sure.
Yeah, that colon in the title apparently was not present in the title in the U.S. theatrical release, but then I guess it went by just The Admiral, I think, theatrically, and then for home video, it was released as The Admiral : Roaring Currents. That tends to be a bad sign.
Yeah, it's a track record. It's not a policy.
I won't agree to that.
I wonder how this film went over in Japan. Like, especially if Korean actors playing the Japanese characters are not doing a great job pronouncing the Japanese lines that they're delivering. It's a movie that where the Japanese are definitely the bad guys, but also we spend a lot of time with them. Like even the Pirate King Japanese character Kurashima is like, he's kind of like dark and sinister, but he doesn't have like evil intentions. He's not, you know, like, I guess he's got like a little bit of a revenge axe to grind, but they're there because they were ordered to come, you know, attempt to invade Korea, not because they're like bad men that want to do bad things for no good reason.
Yeah, the movie is very sympathetic to the Japanese position a lot of the time. They are committing atrocities, cutting off people's noses and whatnot, but the like you say, the high command.
I don't want to turn a blind eye to the atrocities of the Japanese.
Right. You're absolutely right, Ben, and I think that is in the record now that you are against atrocities.
Okay.
You are Ben, and you know what? I don't want to speak for Adam, but I feel like we're all against atrocities here.
I mean, I would say depending on the atrocity is where I fall.
And if you don't say it out loud, I don't think anybody would assume that you're anti-atrocity.
Right. Part of it is that we have to have a feeling that they are a competent military force and not just a bunch of bunglers, because that's the only way that we end up fully understanding the heroism of the Admiral.
And I think that, like, critically part of that is that some of them know that he has 12 ships, but he's super dangerous anyways. Like, they outnumber him so vastly that, you know, Kurashima is like, yeah, we're going to roll over this guy. And the other guys are like, no, he's actually kicked our ass a bunch of times and we're scared of him, even though he only has 12 ships.
I think this movie does a great job of actually setting it up. There are so many movies like this where the premise is, here's a commander who's against all odds, and you know he's going to win in the end. And so get ready to watch him kick a bunch of ass with his, you know, his like small band of a ragtag fugitive fleet. But this movie does a great job of having multiple situations where you go, well, the jig is up here. They cannot possibly win.
They don't have the turtle ship. You need the turtle ship. The turtle ship is the key to the whole thing.
He knows he needs the turtle ship. He's crying. He needs the turtle ship so bad.
I love how this movie recognizes your desire to see the turtle ship in action so much that after burning it down and giving us the terrible feeling of seeing it die, that it gives you like a postscript, here's what the turtle ship was like when it was used sort of scene. That was great.
That was awesome.
That was turtle ship fan service, right? Like, some people didn't like that.
Admiral Yi invented the turtle ship, or like greatly improved on it. They existed for like 200 years before that, but like the one depicted in this is like a real thing that is he's credited with innovating, and it's like the first kind of like armored warship of its kind in the world.
South Korean wooden turtle ship, South Korean wooden turtle ship, South Korean wooden turtle ship, turtle ships kick ass.
I thought you were going to go with something like burned it before the battle, no more turtle.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of the special effects? I mean, we spend a lot of time at sea, a lot of naval battles, a lot of what appear to be CGI boats.
Yeah. They built like 8 real boats for this and then CG'd the rest of them. And I thought like it really like wildly swung back and forth over the course of this film. Like the earliest shots we see of these ships on the water are so bad and so fake looking that I was really worried. I was like, oh God, this battle is going to be rough. And then the battle was pretty exciting and pretty well done, I thought.
Yeah. And what are the reasons for that? It's because we're cutting far closer. All the sequences are aboard the ship or at the waterline as the ships are ramming into each other.
Yeah.
It's the wide shot that gives it away. And I think, you know, you can't show this battle without showing a wide shot. It's impossible. But I think that the film did what it could in not lingering wide too often.
But you're right. The establishing shot, the establishing wide shots were bad CGI. And it took me a while to realize that there were real ships in action here and it wasn't all CGI because I got kind of like stung at the start. I think a big part of what made the CGI look bad is that the bow wave and the wake of some of the ships, they just looked, is this wooden ore powered ship really moving 25 knots? I don't think so.
Right. I had the exact same note. It's how, is it possible to generate a wake with just oar power on a boat that big?
Well, and especially like a bow wave, like I mean, you didn't get a feeling. And I think a ship this size that's being oar powered like that, I'm not sure that you would get that surging that you get with an oar, you know, an oared boat where it's like, but there's got to be at least a little bit of that, right? I mean, the boat has to be visibly not lurching, but moving organically and not just feeling like it's that there's somebody with a stick that's pushing it.
The Japanese boats had more of like a pointed bow too, so they seemed a little bit more like hydrodynamic, whereas the Korean ones were like, they were like Mack truck fronts where they maybe created that bow wake just because they're creating so much turbulence in the way they're designed, or turtlebulence in the case of that. In the case of that one ship.
It was interesting to me, and I don't know enough about the world of 15th century warships.
Shakespeare is often Avon writing plays, and this is happening on the other side of the world.
But the use of sail versus oar, if we think about the big epic naval battles of the Greek and Roman period, a lot of those boats are oared. You know, during this period in China, like there are junks, right? Like sail-powered ships. But these were, none of these boats had anything other than just sort of ceremonial sails. I wonder at the side-by-side evolution of sail power and oar power and why oars would have been utilized almost exclusively in these battles. They weren't using wind at all.
Because they had sails. Like you could see them tied up on the right. decks.
And they had plenty of wind going on. You know, there it's not like...
And like the evolution of naval warfare is such that like, what, 1,500 years passed between like Spartacus style, bang on a drum, oar powered naval vessels and what we're seeing in this film. And what changed? Nothing changed. Why didn't the boats get much better?
There were a lot of nautical technologies that came out of China, like cross beam bracing and rudders that you could raise and lower.
Yeah, it sure wasn't just an oar that was happening. There was like a, what am I trying to say? Like it's not just a straight piece of wood. There's like a crank at the end of it that's helping you get leverage from inside the boat. Like there's a greater technology happening, but it's subtle.
They definitely look way better than the kind of oars that like galleon slaves in the Roman time would have had.
Well, and I loved the fact that ramming was a major war technology at this point. And the Korean ships, you know, sank a lot of the Japanese boats by just full on just crashing straight into them.
The hood ornament wasn't just decoration. There's utility there.
I loved that as a fighting strategy.
That reminded me of those scenes in Red Cliff where they're like, you know, using like barrels of oil and stuff to like ram and then like light the other ships on fire. And that's like 1400 years earlier in history, right? Like naval technology has like really leapt forward in the last 500 years.
Yeah, so has airplane technology.
Not to mention internet technology.
That's really gone through the roof too, yeah.
Yeah, the internet stuff in this movie sucks.
But like fire ships were played a plot role, and we saw that too in the Three Kingdoms,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Redcliffe.
Except we never got to be on board one of those ships the way we are here. I thought that was a really fun wrinkle. Like the fire ships of previous films, we would just see approaching as a threat. But when we see Lim, the scout, aboard the ship, trying to get their attention, it feels so dangerous to be aboard that thing.
Yeah. There's an awful lot of kind of spiritual subtext that I could feel in this movie. A lot of, and I wondered, I don't really know the history of religion in Korea, but my sense is that now it is a very Christian country. Like I read like this whole article about like COVID and how the mega church thing in Korea wound up like really exacerbating their problem there.
Oh, I think that there is a lot of Christianity in Korea because of all the occupations, but I think that Christianity is like 20% and Buddhism is 20%. It's
Yeah, I'm seeing no religion 56%, Protestant Christianity 19%, Korean Buddhism 15.5%. This movie kind of in a way that I think we've picked up on in kind of more, you know, right-wing oriented American films, kind of appealing to a spiritual nationalistic kind of conception of history, and a lot of this stuff with like the fire ship made me think that like the way they're like, you know, praising God, praising providence when that doesn't wind up destroying the admiral's ship. The questions about that at the end.
And that was, I thought, really interesting at the end when the son wanted his father to say that God had rescued or Providence had rescued the Navy and his father kept saying that it was a couple of times in the movie that it was the peasants of Korea that made the nation. And that whether that was pandering to the to present day South Korean sensibilities or whether that's something rooted in history. But, you know, the thing about Buddhism is that it's a religion that's much less about there being a godhead and more about there being a kind of, you know, a spiritual ethic. And as that moves to like Confucianism and further progressions of Confucianism and Zen Buddhism, it becomes more and more a rational, non-divine religion. So I, you know, the Christian comparison, you know, there's a lot of ancestor worship happening, but I don't think there's that same sort of like God changed the wind to blow in our favor stuff.
Yeah. Cause that played a big role in Redcliffe. Did divine providence help us, or did like our very advanced understanding of weather
rise?
Like the stuff about the whirlpool definitely seems kind of adjacent to that in terms of like how it's conceptualized in this film. Like, how did you know to use the whirlpool? Well, I mean, like we've been talking about this whirlpool phenomenon in this strait like all movie long, and it does seem like it would be a thing you could use if you know that this is where the battle is going to be.
I was gratified that the whirlpool, it seemed like they were building up to having a scene where the whirlpool became like sea monster-y and and all 30 Japanese ships were just swallowed up in a giant whirlpool. And it was quite a bit more restrained than that. At the very end, you did get that picture of a gyre where it felt like the whirlpool was going to destroy the admiral's ship. But that became a pretty interesting scene when the peasants came out to rescue him.
I really like how the plan wasn't in a straight line and how chaotic it became once the whirlpool was introduced as a strategy. Like, it wasn't like, oh, if we can just lure them into the whirlpool, everything will be fine. That's just the point where shit really went off.
Right.
But like, there was no safety there. It was just as dangerous for the Admiral as it was for anyone else. And especially like that moment when the Admiral's ship is totally surrounded by all those ships, it feels like moonshot after moonshot is what Yi has to employ in order to survive and
right.
and destroy the enemy fleet. It's, I know that like divine responsibility is an argument made for how you know Yi's fleet was able to survive and win, but like, isn't that always the case when there's a statistical improbability that takes place? Like, any time the underdog wins in that kind of way, it is never. Ben, you articulated this a while ago, I think probably on another show, but like, when something has a 20% chance of winning, it doesn't mean that it never has a chance of winning.
Right.
and so often in movies like this and in battles, like we're given the impression that it would be impossible for such a thing to take place, but it is not statistically impossible.
But in that scene in particular, when the Admiral's ship is has four Japanese ships both tied to him and four separate Japanese yeah. crews are on his ship and hand-to-hand combating, and they are out of gunpowder and shells.
Was that the tracking shot scene where we go all the way around the ship and we...
Yeah.
That was amazing.
That was fucking great.
It's not really communicating that they have a 20% chance of victory there.
Right.
My sense of it was that they had a 0.0% chance of victory. And I felt like any situation now where they pull this off is going to feel fake. It's going to feel like the South Koreans, this is their foundation myth, and this guy has superpowers. And there's no way they can do it. And then somehow what he pulls off is believable. And you just throw up your hands and are like, wow, killer. I mean, that was killer.
I love the, has anyone ever attempted to, like, I don't know, tie a bunch of the cannons together? Fire them all at once?
Fire them all at once.
Have we done that? Can we do that? I love seeing all of the different weapons employed here, like the shoulder-fired mini cannon we get in this movie. I'd never seen that before.
Yeah, the pre-industrial bazooka.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, like from blades to guns, like the... Like, I didn't know what to expect in this. I had no idea if there were going to be cannons even for the beginning part of the movie, because... It takes, I mean, like, this is basically one battle, you know, like the first hour is prep for the battle and the second hour is the battle.
I was just impressed and delighted with how this movie spent its time. Like, yeah. We are not going back and forth.
I think it's really amazing to make a battle scene that's 1 hour long that mm-hmm. feels varied and interesting and keeps your attention.
Although it is an interesting question how... The other 12 ships or the other 11 ships in this Admiral's Navy, how all of those crews weren't brought up and court-martialed and sentenced to death. Like
beheaded.
they just hang back and wait for the Admiral to get sunk, presumably because they're all going to raise the white flag. And they watch him get his ass kicked all around the block.
Yeah.
Before they finally, and I have to say, kind of half-assedly, join the battle.
I was wondering if that was part of the plan too, because this is definitely one of those movies where a commander has a brilliant plan that he's not telling anybody about because it's more dramatic for him to like reveal it by right. turns. And so I was expecting it to be like, that was great the way you 10 guys hung back in the cut until I, you know, put up this one flag that was your signal to enter the battle.
Yi makes the case over and over again that he needs to turn fear into something else, like fear into courage, perhaps. But like the idea of all those boats hanging back to me did not serve that theory. To me, those were people being practical and not fearful. And I wonder if that was something that was lost in the translation.
I don't think so. I felt like it was the least satisfying part of the film. Look, I get you don't show your hand to the bad guy. I get that you command respect by being taciturn, but multiple times your fellow captains are begging you to tell them the plan. And he's just like, meeting adjourned. And it's like, wow, I don't know, man. You got to give us something.
That's got to be made up for dramatic purposes, right?
It took away from the narrative to make him such a lone wolf, because what it did was it made it seem less like a strategy and more like he was just making it up as he went. And maybe that's how, maybe that is the point of the movie, that he was just like...
Or that he was cruel and insane from his experience being tortured and imprisoned. Like, there was that aspect to his character that I couldn't quite stop thinking about as I saw him make his decisions. Right. Like, how... was he irreparably damaged from that? And that's why things are happening?
Yeah, that's true. That was present, wasn't it? That he had just lost his grip?
Yeah.
It made me think of, like, is this going to be like, is it like the son, like the emperor in that movie we watched, where he's like kind of nuts, and it's a bit about a crazy person doing an amazing thing?
Even in the pitched battle, some of the tensest and maybe most frustrating scenes are when it's clearly time for him to issue a command, and he waits and waits. And it's like, how much time do we have here? And it did, over time, make you feel like he's just crazy and is just pulling this off because luck did not deliver one cannonball to your magazine, right? Like, he's sinking ships right and left, where he's basically like, one cannonball hits below the waterline and the ship breaks up and sinks. So did he win this naval battle just because he was crazy and lucky?
I mean, I wonder to what extent this is a film speaking an action film language, a language that goes like, we, even though the last hour of this film is a protracted naval battle, it cannot be high tension throughout. We must lower the volume for a moment and show someone thinking about the next move before we see that next move happen.
Right.
Like, I totally get what you're saying. It feels crazy. If you were to place yourself into the film as if it were really happening in real life, that would be crazy making. But in a film language, I wonder if they're riding attention here intentionally, where you have to duck down and be quiet for a moment to pop back up and get loud.
I don't know. Like, thinking about the other Admiral, Wang Yun, that he blew it and then went and like locked himself in his ship for a week and wouldn't talk to anybody. Like, that's like a toddler throwing a tantrum. And like, there's, this movie elucidates the emotional maturity of all these dudes several times. Like, how many times are we in a scene where a bunch of generals and captains are having a conversation about what to do, and they're on the verge of pulling swords out and chopping each other's heads off because they disagree about something? Like, maybe that's the position that this film is taking, that it's just like a different time and these people are not behaving like modern adults.
When we watch Master and Commander or naval battles that are taking place in the Age of Sail, the maneuvering that it takes to get your cannons facing their cannons and to come at them with the wind at your advantage so that you can, you know, fire that fusillade and then turn and get back on them and hit them again. Like, that's a whole, like, exciting, crazy aspect of naval warfare in the Age of Sail. I had never seen this, where he anchored his boat, he had the oars pull him broadside, fired a salvo, and then spun the ship around and fired from the other side. And it felt like, that's incredible.
Like, presumably because it's faster to flip the entire ship around than to reload those guns?
Yeah, all it takes is one side of your oars to lift up and the other side to crank hard, and you can kind of spin in place if your anchor, it holds. And I just wanted to see that strategy employed again. Like, if he had brought all 12 boats up and they had done that where six of them were firing and six of them were turning, and while they were turning, they were reloading. Like, that seemed like great.
Yeah, like the naval equivalent of volley fire.
Yeah, right. So, that would have explained how the Japanese that were coming straight on could never maneuver in the same way, and the current would have been against them, and so forth and so on. But we really only saw that once. And I spent the rest of that battle wanting to see that again. Like, do that thing where you shoot and then you spin. Because those Age of Sail battles were all about that. I mean, it was just like, get close, let loose. And then whoever can get the drop on the other ship coming around is the, you can only take three or four volleys before they shoot down your mast or whatever.
Yeah. Who are the guys with the swastika vests that offer their assistance right before the battle starts?
The fighting monks.
That must be one thing that you're just like, I know exactly what this is if you're in a movie theater in South Korea. But I didn't know what those guys were.
Yeah, they had it's a backward swastika from the Nazi one.
I personally think that the Nazi one is the backwards one.
Hear, Ben. You know what? I agree with you, and I too am against atrocity.
I'm trying to normalize the monk version by wearing it out in public all the time. And guys, I got to tell you, does not go well.
My wife has actually banned Adam from our house, and that was prior to the lockdown.
I put the Shaolin version of the symbol on my car in a bumper sticker. Car's on fire when I came out.
Weird. You would think people would see, oh, that's the forwards one, not the backwards one.
Yeah, weird.
I do feel like the presence of the monks was another... It was another example of the idea that I think behind this, which was all of Korea was eventually going to rally to the admiral and his battle, because this was like a Korean last stand.
Yeah.
And those monks are good fighters. You'll notice they're like fighting with hooks and axes and stuff.
They kick a ton of ass, and they also help the oarmen out. They're like swapping out with them to give them a break.
I loved the fact that the oarmen were all shown with bloody hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really love the two guys we get to meet who are the oarsmen, who don't even know what ship they're on until the portholes opened and then shut in front of them. Like, oh God, are we really on the flagship? This is terrible luck. Like, I love every once in a while cutting to them for just a little bit of tension release. I thought they were used really well. And it's one of the few examples we get of some real like class distinction going on here.
Yeah. You notice that when it starts going badly for the guys up on the deck, they have all the people down below come up to help them. But then when the guys down below need help, where are the people from the deck?
Yeah.
Way to go, Ben. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need.
It's about time that the people from above deck.
For far too long, the above deck class has taken advantage of the oarsmen.
The conflict we've been talking the most about seems to be like Yi's conflict with his own people. But I really like what's going on between the two enemy admirals, the Kurashima and the Wakazaka character, between themselves. The idea of the pirate character being just a little too out there for Wakazaka to deal with, but Wakazaka being the guy that was defeated previously by Yi-sun, so they both really have a lot of skin in this game.
Yeah.
They're different methods and tactics, both resulting in the same end. They both, I thought, were really interesting characters, too. They weren't just monsters. Like, I thought they were going to make him into a Thulsa Doom character, like with the giant headdress that he wears and just the evil staring. I thought he would be cartoonish, but he was not. He was someone to be taken seriously throughout.
The mask does kind of lose a little bit in translation, like when he puts it on for a dramatic effect. Like, and it's like an angry face with a fake mustache stuck onto it. It's like, what?
I think we have talked about this before when we watch movies featuring martial arts. Like, there is a flowiness to costuming that can really make a character seem magical or bigger than life. And when Kurashima boards the ship wearing the mask and he goes after Yi-sun Sin, like, he is enormous there. And when they fill him full of arrows, it just seems like he'll be unkillable.
He's just that angry, though.
And that was a great, like, climax of the movie for him to come on board. Yeah. And I think historically he is the only like samurai class leader that died in this battle. So he was a real person and he really was the highest ranking Japanese officer to be killed. So to have him board the ship and actually like die in hand-to-hand combat, pretty effective narratively.
Kirishima really gets fucked over here too by Todo, like, because Todo chooses not to reinforce him.
Yeah.
When the shit is starting to go down, like, Kirishima is also like into it. Like, there's no going back for him. And so by the time he realizes that reinforcements aren't coming, he's pot committed.
He is. And he feels, I mean, he dies of hubris, right? He was the one that through the whole film kind of blew off any suggestion that Yi Sun Sin was so formidable that he needed to be taken more. I mean, it's not that he never took him seriously, but he just felt like, come on, give me a break.
We outnumber him 30-1. Like, let's be real here. We're going to kick his ass.
Right. Also, I'm a serious badass that has a mad kitty cat helmet on. This guy has no chance. And then at the end, you know,
I'm looking at the helmets over there and they look like a bunch of garbage helmets compared to this one.
They're all basically the same ziggurat design. Look at all these crazy helmets we got on this side.
We got blood crazier helmets. The guy with the butterfly wing helmet.
That guy had the best helmet.
Throughout this battle scene, there are multiple times where we cut to one of the Japanese admirals, and all that character says is, in an awestricken voice, "Yi Sun Sin." Like, more than once, we cut over to someone who is just dumbfounded at every successive moment, and it really works. Each time I was like, "Yeah, that's right, fella, Yi Sun Sin," and you haven't even seen the whirlpool yet, fool.
No, wait until you get that whirlpool put underneath you.
Wait till the 11 other ships show up.
I like the one old man who is kind of the boyfriend of the turtle ship.
He was the architect of it, or he was the builder of the turtle ship.
Yeah. Or the boyfriend.
Sure. That's what that's a Korean translation is, boyfriend of ship. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just standing up on that bluff, screaming turtle ship to the heavens.
Turtle ship!
The flag budget for the Japanese military has got to be insane.
Awesome.
Like when you're the chief financial officer of this era of Japanese military and you're looking at like all the line items, you're like, you know, we could actually save like 10% of total by just eliminating flags from how we deploy our military in the field.
You go to the rat party for this film, you know you're taking one of those home.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone gets one of those flags.
Everybody gets a flag. I mean, it's in real contrast to the like American military now in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the flag budget is all spent on Punisher t-shirts, it seems like.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've taken a sharp turn toward dork fascism in this country. So,
I mean, there was the Japanese captain wearing the Chanel logo.
Oh yeah, that was pretty cool.
On his head. That felt a little out of place. Who would have thought that product placement would be in this film? But there he is.
I think that Captain Bay probably deserves more credit for this victory than he's given in this movie, because he saved all the boats, like, through an act of cowardice is what everybody says. But like, they wouldn't have the 12 boats if he hadn't seen the writing on the wall. Like, this Won Gyun guy is getting us shellacked over here. I'm gonna make like a tree and get out of here with my ships.
Well, and that whole thing was historically accurate, that he chickened out of the battle, saved the 12 ships, and then tried to desert a second time and was caught and executed. He wasn't executed by an arrow fired into his forehead from 300 yards away, but...
Desert you once, shame on me. Desert you twice, shame on you. That was a hell of an arrow shot.
It was. There were a few of those, few sniper shots that strained credulity.
I am always going to like do a little fist pump when stuff like that happens in movies. That's just like hitting a fleeing submarine.
a bullet through the eye, huh?
Yeah. I just love that million to one shot.
I mean, that we're talking about like unrifled barrels and
yeah.
That sniper is firing from a ship. So a vessel that's bobbing up and down and firing at another ship, another vessel bobbing up and down.
I liked that they never gave a false like zoom in factor for that guy, though. Like they always show him shooting from, you know, with like a 50 millimeter lens. So you can see how far away the thing he's bullseyeing really is.
Right.
You know, he doesn't have like superpowers in like filmic terms. Like he's amazing, but he's not like superhuman.
There's only a little bit of like battlefield slow-mo in this film. Compared to a lot of contemporary war movies where we go into slow-mo every time people are fighting, there is some here.
Yeah, well, there's that one-er where it like goes around the entire deck of the ship, and it's maybe the most successful like moving tableau I've ever seen in a film.
It was really incredible, and the only thing that took me out of it were there were a couple of scenes where people were clearly pulling their sword punch.
Yeah.
It's got to be so hard to have 50 people fighting in a sprawling sequence and not have at least one person who's hitting another one with a plastic sword and trying not to actually hurt them.
When the shot is that long, it's essentially challenging you to find the mistake, though.
It's challenging an actor to not just go 1-2, but go 1-4. Like, what are two other things you can do sequentially to sell your fight? One thing that stuck out to me from that sequence, Ben, was like my entire life, I feel like you watch people use these swords in a certain way. You're just slicing off arms and heads. But in this film, you get that sword being used with two hands.
Yeah. Like turning it around and pulling it toward a guy.
Yeah. Or like sawing into them using both hands, like the closed one hand, open one hand. Like I've never seen the swords being used that way before in a film. It's really using the whole buffalo.
It seemed like the Koreans had a very similar type of sword to the, like I, you know, because we have so much Japanese culture available to us in the US, I'm familiar with katana and wakizashi as ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if Korea has a very similar sword culture to Japan. And I like never even thought about it before this movie, but it seems like this movie is making the case that like a Japanese samurai facing off against a similarly trained Korean warrior of the same era was like basically on pretty even footing.
Yeah. We rarely got that kind of battle presented though, right? It felt like so often it was sword against guy with hammer or gun against arrow or any other mix. Like the film rarely had a strong conviction about like our guys are better than those guys in a totally even fight.
It's the Batman versus Superman thing where you're like, okay, like what if we took like one of the Admiral's top dudes and pitted him against like whatever the top military guy in the UK was at this time? Like what would the odds be? Who would be better? And it also made me think like the Japanese being the bad guys in this movie is a familiar position for them to be in a war movie, especially for us, given the list of films we've watched. I wonder if somebody could do some data analysis on the movies we've watched and give us like a scatter plot of who has been the bad guys the most.
Interesting. I don't know.
Would it be the Japanese or the Germans? I mean, we've watched an awful lot.
Someone generated a graph that proves how much John hates movies.
Did they really? What did it say?
By that, I mean someone generated a graph that shows how we've rated all the films in the Friendly Fire Project.
The bell curves are in three different places. Mm-hmm. Like the graph that they made is based on a false supposition, which is that five things is five things.
Right.
Five things is not five things.
It's an impossible graph to make. They should do is make 200 different graphs. It's review time on Friendly Fire, and we can't review a film without a rating system. It's impossible. This has been a really fun conversation about a film I definitely never would have seen without Friendly Fire's encouragement. I hope our listenership goes out and watches this film too, even if it's just the last hour. I think there is an hour here that is just an action film, that is maybe even a best of breed action film that I really enjoyed, and I think a lot of other people would too. But we review the entire film, and the rating system comes from a few events that happen fairly early on in it. There's a rating system in this film that's above all the rest. I think there are some horrible images presented here that I thought, oh my God, is this going to be like just a grisly war film that gives us nothing but severed heads? You get that ship full of heads, and then you get the grieving of the heads, like the burial of the heads later, and then Kirishima. Like, that's what he does. Like, he's heads guy. Even Wakizaka's like, you should give it a rest with the heads thing, Kirishima. It's pretty messed up. Yi Sun Sin, he gets in on that action. He cuts the head off of that deserter to emphasize discipline. And then he cuts the head off of Kirishima at the very end. I think it's obvious what the rating system is for this movie. It's severed heads.
They put Kirishima's head up on the mast.
There are some things that you want to see in this film that it doesn't give you. I want to see, how do you get the head up the top of that mast? What are you tying it to? It's the hair, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's got to be the hair thing. Like, logistically, I want answers to these questions.
There's not like a head cradle or something they're using.
You know what? You cut off enough heads in this era that I'm sure there's head technology.
I bet they just finished a bag of Satsumas, and they grabbed that little Satsuma bag, put the head in it.
It sends a message, whether it's a single head on a mast or just a whole open grave full of severed heads. It really makes a strong point. And I think the assembled hosts of Friendly Fire will be tasked with the strength of their ratings based on how many heads to use in this case. I was blown away by this movie. And I think what helped my affection for it was approaching it with such reluctance. Like, there's a lot to take on here. This feels like thousands of years ago, and it feels a world away. There are not very many footholds here for understanding, and you just need to trust a film is going to teach you what you need to know to understand its characters and its motivations. And I think this film ably does. I think the costumes and the sets are amazing, among the best that we have seen on a Friendly Fire movie. Costumes that famously injured the actors wearing them. They were so heavy and embellished. Like Yi Sun Sin's dragon adornments on his shoulders. Like, who has actual dragon epaulets? Like, those were amazing. So gorgeous. I think a film like this fulfills the promise of what Friendly Fire is all about, and that's like discovering how a country views itself during wartime and how meaningful their war stories are to their culture. And we don't get a lot of these, and I hope we get to watch more. I'm gonna give it 4.25 heads.
Nice score.
And I'm gonna make that quarter head the top part, not the stump. I'm talking about like the scalp part of the quarter, maybe down to the eyes. No, the eyes are in the middle of the head. We all learned that in art class. So no, definitely above those eyes, maybe even above the eyebrows.
Hmm.
4.25 heads.
I like the score of 4.25 heads, and I think I'm going to join you right there, and I'm going to give it eyes to nose. Include the nose in there, because like so many noses get cut off in this movie.
I had my choices of dismembered body parts as a rating system, and
I mean,
right or wrong, I went with the head.
That close-up of the nose coming off is probably the worst part of the movie. Very, very upsetting. This is a movie that I didn't see coming. I kind of carried that that reticence into the movie, the there's a colon in the title of this. Mm-hmm. And then like the the opening sequence that shows the, you know, that has like text on screen describing the kind of antecedent events to what we're about to see is so corny. And it was like, oh God, like they show the Japanese invading the Korean peninsula as like green, like liquid flowing over it, like it's some kind of infestation. I was like, this is the red bad of Korea. I'm really worried about this. Like there's a sword fight early in the film and I wrote like, what the fuck is going on? But like the film won me over. It was too good to keep that prejudice, frankly, going. And eventually I had to set it aside and just enjoy a really kick-ass action film that like definitely is interesting for the fact that it is not speaking to my culture. Like there are like signals in this that you can tell are signals, but you can't decode if you don't, you know, if you don't know the culture that they're pointed toward. And it only makes me more curious to, you know, visit Korea one day to learn more about it. If this is one of like the founding fathers of your society or whatever, like he did some really cool shit. And I also just like have to praise this movie for being maybe the only motion picture in history to show a character coughing some blood into a hanky early in the film and never addressing it again. I was like, oh, this guy's got tuberculosis. So like at some critical moment, he is going to like fade out and, you know, either die or need to rally the last of his strength. Nope, he's fine. That one at a quarter head, just in that.
I have never seen a movie that had such a dramatic score as this film. And that score is present throughout. And it was what caused me to realize going in that there was not going to be any humor in this movie. There's that one moment at the end of the battle when we're in the bowels of the ship and the oarsmen are all bragging about how important they were to the battle. Funny, it's meant to be a palate cleanser that these guys are like, I was the real hero of this battle. And that is 2 hours into a movie where no one smiled. Like there's not a smile in the movie. And so although it is a great war movie, this is just like a self-esteem movie.
Yeah.
That every once in a while a country puts out a self-esteem movie to just be like, you know what? We're ass kickers too. The United States does it all the time now to the point that self-esteem movies are ridiculous. I mean, we've gotten bad at it. This is a great self-esteem movie. There was no palate cleanser. There was no break in the tension. And as I'm sitting here trying to think of what I wanted, everything I can think of would have made it worse, not better. So I was going to ding it a quarter head for that. But I think I just convinced myself that would have been a bad ding. I'm going to give it 4.25 heads.
Wow.
Wow. All right.
That's all three right in at the same level.
Different headquarters though.
Yeah, my head is like from a slash. So it's one ear across and then the chin. One ear, the chin, and some like some like neck.
Well, you want to get the cheek in there. That the cheek's the best part.
A cheek, yeah. You know, it goes,
I like
it
that.
Goes, yeah, above the ear, the cheek, across the face.
Good one.
Most of a chin, yeah.
That is fucking great. Adam, did you have a guy?
Yeah, I thought for sure that I was going to make Lim the Scout my guy, but when I was listening to John talk about the dearth of a like romantic subplot here, it made me think about the one little bit that this film gives you, and it's Lim's lady friend. Like when he is on the Hay ship and he's communicating to her from shore, like there's some magic happening there. Like he's so far off of shore, he's still able to communicate with her. He needs her to signal. He needs her to take off her clothes and do a signal that helps that helps get the attention of Yi Sun Shin's ship so that the Hei ship can be shot before it rams it. And I thought, like, you don't get a lot of scenes between them, but there is a very real affection between them that felt necessary. Like, and it's not a lot, and I think an American film would have leaned into this into full, like, B storyline, but this film rightly does not, and it just gives us... What it does is it gives us enough to grieve Lim's death, because if Lim's lady friend isn't there, Lim is just another scout who gives himself up for the cause. But it's Lim's lady friend and then all of the other people up on shore who are feeling this moment of great sacrifice. And it's what served the scene so well, and it's what made me feel so much during it. So I'm going to make my guy Mrs. Zhang. Mrs. Zhang is Lim's wife.
Toward the end of the battle, it's like starting to finally kind of turn for Admiral Yi, and you know, they have to do a little bit more fighting before they're, you know, totally in the clear. But they're getting toward the point where they're turning the tide on the Japanese. There's a soldier on the deck of Yi's ship who's clambering, and I think they get hit, or they hit some turbulence, and a cannon falls on this guy's hand.
That's pretty amazing.
And I am sure that would be me in a battle like this. like if I didn't get run through by somebody's katana, I would catch a cannon on the hand.
So. I love a movie that gives us that detail. Not everyone knows what it's like to have their head cut off with a sword, but like dropping something heavy on a hand.
Everybody's had that happen to them. Yeah. And I don't know, like it's weird doing this project because I like read so much more about war than I ever would have if we hadn't started Friendly Fire. And like one thing you always read is like, oh, you know, almost equal numbers of soldiers die when they go to war from like disease and shit than as die from, you know, wounds sustained in combat. And that's like almost never the story that you tell in a war film, because that's, you know, that's not epic or, you know, heroic or anything. It's just like, oh yeah, this guy went and sat in a trench for a year and got, you know, pneumonia, and that was the end for him. But like cannon on the hand guy, I'm sure that happened a ton, especially in like pre-modern navies like this. Like it had to just be like a fact of life. Like, oh yeah, like every like 9 days somebody gets caught in the ropes and like thrown overboard. So he's my guy.
My guy is definitely the Japanese admiral that is wearing the gold hat with the butterfly wings.
Yeah.
I feel like that is such a
cool hat.
That hat definitely indicates that you do not intend to get into any hand-to-hand combat today. And I feel like that going into battle with a really, really impractical hat is such a power move. The thing about like having an angry kitty mask with a like a crazy buffalo head helmet with horns sticking out of it, that says, let me in to this battle. Even though I'm the admiral, give me, you know, that's like a pearl handled revolvers. But a hat with gold like insect wings, that suggests that you're not gonna reinforce the rogue general. You're gonna make a pot of tea on your way back to base. And I felt like he never breaks a sweat either. He just kind of smirks his way through that whole thing.
Wow. Fun movie. Fun guys. Feeling pretty fortunate here. Yeah. I love when a movie comes out of nowhere and surprises us the way this one did. I wonder what surprises are in store for us next time.
What we've decided to do for next week to close out the drive is drop a pork chop film into the main feed. This is if you already subscribe, you will have gotten this episode already. But if you aren't supporting the show, you know, and you do that by going to maximumfun.org/join, if you're not already doing that, you're going to get a little taste of what goes on behind the paywall with a episode we are very excited about. Adam, tell them what the movie is.
It's a classic little ditty from the 80s, starring our favorite precocious teen of that decade. It's Matthew Broderick in War Games.
Now, I have no idea why you threw to Adam on that. Because Adam was like 4 when this movie came out, and Ben, you were just a twinkle in your father's eye.
I think this movie came out the year I was born, actually.
Wow, insane.
The twinkle had been transferred from father to mother.
Are you suggesting your parents went on a date to see this movie?
Oh my God, this might be it. You were conceived in the car after War Games.
Wow.
That's the hottest story.
That's what I call a whopper.
This movie was like my Bible when I was a teenager. Absolutely informed my worldview more than the actual Bible, and probably more than any other single piece of media other than the Encyclopedia Britannica. War Games was it. It set me on the path that delivered me here to your doorstep.
Wild. Well, it's a fun, fun episode, and I hope it will inspire a lot of people to go to MaximumFun.org/join. And thank you to everyone who has supported us over the course of this drive already. And if you haven't yet, no time like the present.
Yeah, thanks for supporting the show. I really appreciate it, and I hope that extra content we provide is more than worth it.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that, and we're going to leave it with Rob's from here. So for Adam Branica and John Roderick, I've been Ben Harrison. To the victor, go the spoiler alerts.
Hey, pro tip, if you support now and gain access to our bonus feed, you can listen to next week's episode without pledge breaks. Friendly Fire is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Ben Harrison, Adam Pranica, and John Roderick. The podcast is produced by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is War by Edwin Starr, courtesy of Stone Agate Music, and our logo art is by Nick Dittmer. Last year, we reviewed The Ottoman Lieutenant from 2017. This movie is a love story between an idealistic American nurse and a Turkish officer in World War I. I should also say this movie is extremely controversial, and the boys definitely talk about that in the review. Friendly Fire is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Just head to MaximumFun.org/join and pledge your support. You gain access to our bonus pork chop episodes, and you help keep the show alive. We're trying to reach 2,000 new and upgrading members, and we can't do it without the support of you. So thanks again, and go check out that BOCO. You can now follow Friendly Fire on Twitter and Instagram under the handles FriendlyFireRSS, in addition to all the discussion groups that are available. So join in the conversation. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Friendly Fire.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.